crossed so much with ecologists, but it would be interesting to know what kind of data they have and what kind of information about bird behavior during extremely hot events. That's an interesting idea. Thanks.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with my guest, Princeton scientist Dr. Jane Baldwin. We're talking about the developing phenomenon of multiple heat waves hitting one after another. Let's get to your findings. Jane, please take as much time as you need to tell us, have return heat waves increased in the last few decades, and what do models show happening in the future?
I'm not sure the time series of the historical period that we have is long enough to really clearly indicate whether back-to-back heat waves have been increasing. We do see some evidence of an increasing frequency of heat waves with climate change. And so at its most basic, you'd expect if you have more heat waves, then they'd be more likely to occur back-to-back. And so I think in general, that's the case. Now, where it becomes a little more complicated, and this is where a lot of the paper was focused, was when we look at projections of future climate using climate models, so what the world will be like with increasing carbon emissions, we find a much higher proportion of heat wave risk coming from these back-to-back heat waves, these kind of heat wave events that exhibit more complex temporal structures than just one period above extremely hot threshold. So given that we see this change, one question you can ask is, well, can this simply be explained by a increase in mean temperature on average temperatures, or is there something in the climate system that's making heat waves kind of group together more, stick closer to one another, and that could be related to some change in variance, we'd say. And what we find, and this was actually surprising at first, though now, of course, it makes a lot more sense to us now, is that essentially all of the change in these compound heat waves and their pattern that we see with global warming and their increase can be quite simply explained by an increase in mean temperature. This change doesn't require complex changes in how temperature is varying over time. So essentially, if you take weather today and you think about moving up its mean to higher values of temperature, then you start to see an increasing number of these compound heat waves and a greater percentage of heat wave risk coming from these compound heat waves. So our initial reaction to that was, well, that's not a super exciting result then. It's so obvious, you know, you just increase mean temperature. But I think where this result is really important is when, A, since it's just rooted in the increase in mean temperature, it makes it much more confident that it is a robust result. If it was rooted in some complex change in temperature variability, we'd have a lot less confidence that climate models would be able to project that. So one point is we're confident this is a robust result. The second point is if you look at how heat wave warning systems work today, so these are systems, you know, if you live in a city like New York, for example, if there are, say, 2 days above, I think it's 95 degrees Fahrenheit, the city government issues a notification to weather forecasters and other bodies in the area to put out warnings. So you turn on your TV, you're looking at the weather, and the guy would say, you know, there's a heat wave warning effect, you know, make sure to drink water, stay indoors, et cetera. So right now how these heat wave warning systems work is they look at the next few days of predicted temperature. And I think one of the key implications of this study is going into the future as we see more and more of these compound heat waves, I think it'll be increasingly important to not only consider the predicted weather, but also consider the recent past history of weather when one is deciding whether to issue a heat wave warning. Does that make sense?
It does make sense. You also stimulated me to think that another factor has got to be the changes in the waviness of the jet stream and the fact that we have some weather systems stalling over certain areas and some blocking happening. And so if it's really hot where you are, it may stay hot like that for quite a long time. This has happened in northern Australia. It's happened in California last year. And I think that could also be a factor driving recurring heat waves.
So that, when I was talking about changes in the variance of temperature, the variability of temperature, if we were seeing more changes in blocking, more blocking events, greater waviness of the jet stream, that would fall under the category of being a change in variance that was affecting heat waves. Interestingly, though, in the context of the climate model we used, we find that those changes in variance, which could be changes in blocking events, for example, frequency of blocking events, really aren't playing a very big role in this result. That's not to say they aren't playing some role, but they're really not a first-order important effect. Now, an important caveat to that is we were looking at one climate model, which we use because it has particularly high resolution in the atmosphere, meaning it has a lot of spatial detail that's useful for looking at these types of extreme events. But it would be useful to see if this result holds up with other climate models, for example.
Along with your co-author, Gabriel Vecchi, you also specialize in the study of climate and Asian cyclones. We've had some terrible tropical cyclones in the past few years. Can we make any good predictions about what will happen with tropical cyclones as the world warms?
Yeah, that's a million-dollar question. So I think there are some things that we have a fair amount of confidence on with regard to tropical cyclones, and there are some things we have somewhat less confidence on. So there are pretty robust projections that the intensity of tropical cyclones will increase with global warming. So you're seeing more Category 5, for example, hurricanes, as opposed to Category 1 or 2, the categories are the Saffir-Simpson scale, which is a way of ranking hurricane intensity, how strong the winds are, et cetera. But the thing we're a lot less sure about is how the frequency of tropical cyclones will change with global warming. There's some evidence that we'll have fewer but fiercer, so meaning we'll have stronger but fewer tropical cyclones. But that result, actually, I'd say regarding the frequency, is still very much under debate. I was actually part of a paper that's currently, it's not quite out, but it should be published soon, that was looking at changes in tropical cyclone frequency in a very high resolution global climate model. And interestingly, it suggests, and this is a global climate model that can simulate tropical cyclones up to Category 5, which is previously climate models were not capable of doing. In the context of that model, we actually don't see a decrease in frequency of tropical cyclones. We see about the same or a slight increase in frequency and an increase in strength of tropical cyclones, which is all to say that I don't think the right takeaway is that frequency of tropical cyclones is definitely going to increase, but I think there's still a lot of uncertainty regarding how the frequency of tropical cyclones will change. And I think this is an important challenge to try to understand this question better for adaptation to our changing climate.
Thanks for that insight. Well, returning to your new paper on repeating heat waves, my quick research into this topic suggests the first heat wave of the season is the most dangerous. It kills people, especially seniors who seem to be slow to adapt. But I wonder if that'll continue to be true when we get multiple heat waves. Maybe that's going to be the real danger as the world warms.
Yeah, so you're hitting on the question that's currently causing me headaches. So I've recently been trying to follow up on my paper, which the paper that was recently published focused primarily on the physical hazard of heat waves, meaning we were looking at temperature. We didn't actually look at mortality data very quantitatively. We looked at some past historical heat waves and how much mortality they caused, but we didn't directly try to relate compound heat wave events in a very rigorous quantitative fashion to mortality. And there are actually pretty complex effects that heat waves have on mortality for the following reasons. So there's a population of people that tends to be most susceptible to perishing during heat waves, as we discussed, the old, the sick, individuals who live alone. And what seems to happen during extremely hot days is there'll be a spike in mortality on that extremely hot day. So more people are dying due to the extremely hot weather. But then sometimes in the days following, you actually see a decrease in mortality. And so what that suggests is that there's some finite pool of people that are really at risk for heat waves. And it's possible that if they perish in an initial heat wave because they wouldn't be around anymore, then you might actually see decreased mortality to a subsequent heat wave. In the converse, it's also possible that you have an initial heat wave and that kind of heats up buildings and overwhelms emergency systems such that a subsequent heat wave would have greater effects. So that's the current question I'm actually grappling with, is trying to understand, do we expect the impacts of these compound heat waves to add linearly, or do we expect two heat waves occurring in sequence, the second one to have greater impacts than the first one, or the second one to have reduced impacts compared to the first one because of this kind of displaced mortality effect? So the result you were talking about, where heat waves early in the season seem to have the biggest impact, there's debate about what the reason, the mechanisms behind that result is. One possibility is that people do adapt. Another possibility is that we're seeing some of this mortality displacement effect. So it's intellectually interesting, but it's troubling how much there's definitely still a lot to understand about how temperature impacts mortality. And the field is making a lot of progress in this direction right now. It's evolved a ton since, say, 2008, when temperature and mortality was just not a field that was studied very closely. But I think there's still a lot to learn.
Yeah, in the 1900s, people didn't even write down if people were killed by heat. They just put down heart attack or stroke or something. So here's a question that I ask most of my scientists towards the end of the interview, and it's, how are you concerned personally with climate change, and does what you know sometimes bother you?
Yes, I am concerned personally with climate change. So I got involved in this field in sort of an unusual way. Most people who end up being atmospheric scientists, I found, have physics or math backgrounds. I actually started out studying environmental policy in college, and I was pretty involved in some advocacy for Massachusetts to have cleaner electricity. But as I was involved in that advocacy, I realized that I'm the kind of person that if you ask me a question about, say, how tropical cyclones are going to change, I tend to get very mired in the whys and the details in answer to the question. So that led me to become a scientist. But trying to do something constructive to help people adapt to this issue we're facing is something that's definitely at the top of my mind when I'm doing my research. I think there are some scientists that would say, oh, well, you need to be careful not to be too much of a do-gooder, you know, that could make the work that you're doing biased in some way. But I think it's possible to both. A lot of the work I do is rooted in just intellectual curiosity. I've done some work on the influence of mountains on hurricanes, for example, and we did that because we just thought it was an interesting question, important for basic understanding of the climate system. But then this heat waves paper, for example, I started working on it because I was concerned that this was a risk that was not understood very well in the face of a changing climate. In terms of personal actions, I try to eat mostly vegetarian now, but I have some food intolerances, so sometimes I need to supplement my diet with meat. I always try and find ways to drive less, but that's a bit of a challenge living in suburban New Jersey. But hopefully, always trying to do better in that regard, never perfect.
That's my life entirely. We're trying to do better, but never perfect. And I have to speak up for doing good. I think we should just keep on aiming for that. We have been speaking with Jane Wilson-Baldwin from the Princeton Environmental Institute. You can find links to the paper that we've been talking about in my show blog at ecoshock.org. Jane, thank you so much for sharing with us on Radio EcoShock.
Yeah, thank you so much. This was great.
Check out all our past programs free at ecoshock.org. Near the start of this program, I warned about rapid thawing of Arctic permafrost, an area that covers about one-fifth of Earth's land surface. Vegetation from thousands of years was fast frozen into icy dirt, unable to decompose. Now, with stunning hot temperatures reaching the Arctic up to four times faster than the rest of the world, all those layers of plant matter will become food for microbes. Unimaginable tons of carbon will be released. And as the Arctic becomes wetter and thaws, thousands upon thousands of new ponds, lakes, and bogs will emit methane instead of carbon dioxide. On a 10-year time span, methane is up to 100 times more powerful as a greenhouse gas than carbon dioxide. Then, it decays into more carbon dioxide. It's a huge danger. In June 2019, I spoke with Canada's preeminent permafrost expert, Dr. Merit Turetsky. Here's a selection from that interview about abrupt permafrost thaw.
This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Scientists have issued a new warning that greenhouse gas emissions from thawing permafrost in the north could be twice what we thought as the world warms. Scientist Merit Turetsky is the lead author of the article in the journal Nature, Permafrost Collapse is Accelerating Carbon Release, as published April 30, 2019. Merit is Associate Professor and Canada Research Chair, Tier 2, at Canada's Guelph University and head of the Turetsky Lab. Studying Arctic carbon cycles, northern fires, soils, and peatlands, she is the author or co-author of almost 200 peer-reviewed papers. From Guelph, Ontario, Merit Turetsky, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thanks so much, Alex.
Well, let's start with some basic facts. How much of the northern hemisphere is frozen year-round?
That's right. So permafrost refers to these soils or earth materials that remain frozen for consecutive years. And we know that it underlies quite a large extent of the northern hemisphere. About one quarter of the landmass in the northern hemisphere is impacted by these permafrost soils. In total, in a country as big as Canada, where I live and work, we think permafrost affects almost 50% of the country. So it's a pretty big landmass being impacted.
I had no idea that half of Canada is frozen.
So, you know, many people, including my family, refer to Canada as a hockey nation, and I beg to differ. I often refer to Canada as a permafrost nation. It's such an important part of our identity here.
Merit, do we know how much carbon could be contained in that permafrost and how that might compare to our emissions from industrial civilization?
We do. So the science on this issue is extremely important to climate policy. And so, you know, there are many scientists around the world. Many of them are collaborators of mine that are working furiously to improve the science on this. Let me unpack your question because it's a really good one. First, we are getting a better scientific assessment of just how much carbon is stored in these permafrost regions. This is a difficult issue just because the sheer mass of land that we're talking about. And the carbon in these soils has been accumulated over many, many thousands of years. In fact, some of this is from the Pleistocene age. So some of the carbon is actually in, you know, former mammoth biomass. So this is a complicated issue because we have to reconstruct back into time over a very large mass of land. What we know now, our best estimates from the scientific community, is that permafrost soils today stores about twice as much carbon as is contained in the entire atmosphere. So there's this big pool or stock of carbon sitting in these soils, in large part because those soils and materials have been frozen and thus locked away from any kind of decomposition or biological activity, literally in Earth's freezer in the ground. What we need to now understand better is what part of that stock, it's not going to be all of it, but what fraction of that stock sitting in the ground in the biosphere is going to be released back to the atmosphere when that permafrost thaws. This is the number that is much less constrained. We are working on it feverishly, but the numbers are still hotly debated by scientists. If all of the permafrost carbon is released to the atmosphere, this would be a catastrophic change in greenhouse gas concentrations. We know now today from science that that's not going to happen. Some proportion of permafrost carbon will be released, and the question is, how large will that proportion be? Our best guess is about 20% of the stock of permafrost carbon is vulnerable to release, and it's going to be released over a slow period of time, probably hundreds of years. So this is an emission from thawing ground in the Arctic that is globally significant. It's like adding another large industrial nation to the emission scene, another United States or another China. But
permafrost carbon release is still smaller than human emissions. It's certainly smaller today, and it likely will remain smaller than human emissions, at least in the near future.
Why do scientists, if I read this right, on your team warn that greenhouse gas emissions from thawing permafrost could be twice what current models expect?
So right now, very few climate models or large-scale models consider permafrost at all. So there are a number of complicated issues in these large-scale models, but the interactions of permafrost thaw and carbon release are not well represented in any of these models. What that means is when you read about scenarios from the IPCC, for example, or scenarios used by governments around the world, those climate scenarios for the future do not account for potential release of carbon from a thawing Arctic. There are a handful of models that are starting to simulate or project permafrost and start to account for that. And what those models are doing, so these are some of the most cutting-edge models used by climate scientists and by governments and policymakers around the world. But right now, these models are only considering a very simple type of permafrost thaw. And we call this vertical thaw or active layer thickening, and it's when surface permafrost thaws very gradually and very slowly over time, but it happens everywhere in the Arctic. And we know that this is happening from measurements being collected across field sites all around the Arctic, all around the world. But what I work on and what my colleagues research is a different kind of permafrost thaw, and this happens in a smaller area of the Arctic, but it happens very quickly, and it's abrupt permafrost thaw. It happens only when permafrost contains a lot of ice in it. So permafrost can be frozen anything in the ground, frozen rock, frozen sand. And you can imagine in your mind, if frozen rock warms up, it's not really going to have that many consequences. It's not going to affect the ecosystem. It's not really containing any carbon. So there's no big changes happening. But if you thaw and warm up a material that had a lot of ice in it, all of a sudden that water can have really big consequences for the ecosystem. And that's, in fact, what we're seeing. Big areas of forest in ice-rich permafrost terrain thawing out in periods of months to a year and actually very quickly being converted into lakes. So a forest switches to a lake in a very short period of time. These are kinds of the land cover changes associated with permafrost thaw that have big consequences for carbon release, particularly methane emissions. And up until now, these are not being considered in any kind of large-scale models. So that's where our paper came in. We're updating the estimates of permafrost carbon release to include not only slow and steady thaw occurring all around the Arctic, but these hot spots of abrupt change that are happening in a smaller area of land in ice-rich permafrost, but nonetheless are having big consequences for carbon release on a per meter square basis.
Well, if we were actually up there, there's some crazy things happening. There's some new almost canyons opening up and drunken forests where you have forests falling over and small lakes or ponds appearing across, I know, Siberia, just suddenly a landscape dotted with small little lakes and ponds. Could you talk to us about the unstable nature of frozen lands known as Yadoma?
Absolutely. So Yadoma or Yadoma is a really interesting historical deposit of permafrost, and it's very rich in ice and in carbon. And I guess this is a really important point, and Yadoma soils really drives this point home. Ice-rich permafrost is very vulnerable to these kinds of sudden landscape changes that you've just covered, and it also tends to be associated with high carbon densities. So this is carbon that used to be in the atmosphere, and it was drawn out of the atmosphere by life living and breathing and respiring and building biomass in the surface of these ecosystems long, long ago. We're talking about Pleistocene grasslands and mammoths roaming those grasslands during the Pleistocene. And those organisms died, and their biomass and its carbon in that biomass was folded into these layers of permafrost. So Yudoma is this old permafrost remnant from this very productive period, almost a grassland steppe-type environment in what is now the Arctic, and it contains a lot of carbon. Today, these areas are sitting in pretty poorly drained areas. There's big pockets of Yudoma soils in Siberia, as you mentioned. There's also pockets in other places. For example, Alaska has large regions of Yudoma soils. So we know that these are soils that are very vulnerable. They're currently frozen, but they're starting to experience abrupt thaw at rates faster than what we've seen in the past. And there's a lot of carbon sitting in those soils just waiting to be rotted, literally rotted by microbial communities once those soils warm up. So they're not able to rot now because the temperatures are too cold when the permafrost is in its frozen state. But once it starts to warm up, there's a lot of very yummy carbon for those decomposers, and you know that temperature constraint on decomposition is lifted. We can see high carbon emissions from these areas in two forms of greenhouse gases, carbon dioxide and also methane.
Could greenhouse gases from thawing permafrost become a serious positive feedback loop where warming creates more gases that lead to more warming?
It absolutely will, and I think our latest study really reinforces that this will be an important issue to consider in our climate system in the future. And it's funny because scientists use the term positive feedback to represent this self-reinforcing loop where climate change feeds in on itself, and you outlined that self-reinforcing loop quite well. But when the public hears the term positive feedback, they say, hey, it must be good news. It's positive, right? So what scientists really should be doing is describing, not using the term positive feedback, but we need to talk about this as a potential amplifier or a self-reinforcing loop. Again, exactly what you said. We have warming that's causing permafrost to thaw and release ancient carbon to the atmosphere, where that carbon is triggering more warming, which causes more thaw, which causes more release of ancient carbon, and so on and so on. We get into this feedback loop where climate change is reinforcing itself. Our models represent some examples of these self-reinforcing loops, but they do not represent these well in the Arctic, and they certainly do not represent them well when it comes to permafrost. So until our models can project these complexities in the climate system in a more nuanced way, we need to continue to gather data and, you know, empirical information from our observations so that models can start to really understand that.
From Canada, we've been speaking with scientist Merit Turetsky. You can find links to the science we talked about in my show blog at ecoshock.org. Merit, thank you so much for contributing to our knowledge here on Radio EcoShock.
Thank you, Alex.
You can listen to or download the full half-hour interview with Merit Turetsky from my website, absolutely free, or find the transcript in my book, Surviving the New Age of Extreme Heat. Just go to ecoshock.org every Wednesday for the blog and free links. So here we are in the horror, sooner than expected. Next week, we will see. Jeff Goodall might appear with his new book, The Heat Will Get You First. Or that may be the following week. In any case, you can expect the best of experts on extreme weather and climate change to sound out the awful truth right here on Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. I really appreciate you listening and caring about our world.